What would happen if we had the audacity, the courage, the boldness, and the presence to lean into our edges and grow from our core? See, in a world that's shaped by yesterday's leaning into tomorrow's, we find ourselves weaving possibilities in an endless constellation of opportunities. The world has shifted. And now we find ourselves in a whole new space-time continuum where lifestyle, business, and consciousness get to share the same office space as your purpose and your brand. Welcome to the Supernova Podcast. I'm your hostess, Lena Ski. This is a never-ending chronicle, a narrative, really, speaking into the emergence, the futurisms, what's on the cusp of what it is we truly are, what it is we're here to really create, how do we bring all of ourselves in and really shift the needle into flow. Eric, welcome to the Supernova Podcast. It is so great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah. I know we tried to do a take one on this, and it feels like there's just going to be so much more enrichment coming out of a take two, especially since we just had Halloween as well. I mean, how appropriate is that in the space cultural world that we just live in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, you wanted to talk about fear-based cultures. And I think that's what makes Halloween so subversive. You know, we're trying to play with the fear. And I think that's what the Mexican Dia del Muerte is also about. It's about playing with the fear and conquering it by not being intimidated by it, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the Day of the Dead, that, first of all, I haven't personally experienced it, but from what I've seen and heard about it, it's just such another way to embrace fear, death, and all these different things. Where watching some kids who decided, no, I want a knife sticking out of my hand, walking around with that. And it's just interesting just to see that juxtapose. But that's the world we live in.
No, I mean, I think it's healthy. I think it's much healthier to express the fears than to not express them, right?
Yes.
And I mean, there's a guy called Bruno Bettelheim, and he's written this amazing book called The Uses of Enchantment. Mm. And he talks about why fairy stories are so important to kids. And it's exactly that. It's externalizing the fear into a monster or a big bad wolf or a wicked witch. Mm-hmm. And then we can deal with the fear. We can practice facing that fear in the fairy story. We can have those models of facing the fear in the fairy story. And then when the kids are faced with a real fear, then they've got a script to follow. It's a very important thing.
It is.
And what I don't realize about those days is before the Second World War, before antibiotics, the leading cause of death among women was childbirth. And what happened in those days, you know, before antibiotics and the whole of human history, what would happen certainly in Western Europe, where they had this monogamous model, the women would die in childbirth, and then the man would get remarried to somebody else. And there was the wicked stepmother. And that's why the wicked stepmother is such a trope in these fairy stories. And that's one of the things that the kids had to deal with, you know. Mm-hmm. Some of the women had some animosity to the children of the previous wife.
Yes.
And so these are some of the real things that the kids had to deal with, you know. And that's why those fairy stories are so powerful.
Yeah, as you say, I'm kind of getting a visual of a masquerade, and it's just a veil in which one can process this work, and really, really powerful. And I can see that there is an element of that in the work that you do in going to cultures and shifting that culture from fear.
So, yeah, let me just introduce myself then. So I run a boutique consulting agency, mm-hmm. and we focus on three things. We focus on strategy, leadership, and innovation. And so I took a portmanteau of those three words, strategy, leadership, and innovation, and we called it Stractorovation. That's the boutique consulting firm that I run. And, you know, what you approached me to do is talk a little bit about having an emotionally healthy organization or a fear-free organization. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I was approached to run a nonprofit organization, 2,500 people.
Wow.
You know, we had 38 middle managers. It was a huge, huge organization. And in fact, the organization was in decline. And part of the reason it was in decline is because they had built up this culture of fear. And that's a very normal thing that happens. You know, we in the Western society, this is how we run organizations. We just run them out of fear, really. And it's suboptimal. And so the organization was, if not in decline, certainly in stasis. They hadn't grown at all for 10 years. And what we decided to do was change the culture, because as Peter Drucker said, you know, the culture will eat strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
And so rather than trying to start with a new strategy, and I'll talk a little bit about what that is, mm-hmm. We decided to start with the culture. Mm-hmm. And the very first team meeting I had with all the managers, I invited a psychologist in, and I had asked her to give me some advice. And I said to her, all I want to do is make sure that everybody feels heard. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really focused on succeeding. I'm not focused on growth. I'm focusing only on the culture. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you do that, you will succeed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was very prophetic, because we did that. And that year we grew by over 12% in a single year from a standing start. We had no growth for 10 years. And then that year we grew by 12.5%. And there were obviously many reasons, and I had a very good team around me, but I think the first thing we did was we changed the culture. We really addressed the culture, and we started by undoing or trying to undo some of the fear that had been built in.
And it kind of just reminds me of that one quote by Franklin Roosevelt, like, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And it is something that is part of, I guess, our human condition. It is, as we were talking about fairy tales, is a tool that can actually catapult us into magical places in a way and help us maneuver different spaces. But what is, in your expertise or in your kind of experience, what has been that fear in that room? Because I'm sure it's a huge range of fears. And it's not what you think it is.
Absolutely. There's kind of two sources, if you think about it. There's the internal fear of, mm-hmm. am I good enough? So this is Brené Brown's work, you know, am mm-hmm. I good enough? Who am I to try and think of these things? And that's the innovation part of my consulting firm. Unless you can overcome those internal fears, there's no way you can do any innovation at all. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the external fears. And this comes from a culture of control. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're very fond of saying we want results. We're very fond of saying that. And the way we want results is we punish mistakes and we reward success. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you're building fear into the organization without knowing it, and unwittingly perhaps, and you've got your heart in the right place. You want the results.
Sure.
But the only way you can do that is by punishing mistakes and focusing on results. And that just drives the fear, this external fear. And then everybody's just terrified. Another big source of fear, of course, is restructuring. I've got a client at the moment, they're going through a big restructure. Mm. Now they want me to come and implement Agile, for example. And I said to them, listen, unless you can suck the fear out of the organization, it doesn't matter what you implement, because there's a lot of fear, and with the fear comes the mistrust. With the fear comes secrets. With the fear comes the bad news doesn't travel upwards fast enough. And that's one of the barometers, in fact, that I use. If I was talking to this leader at this client, and I said, tell me about your week. And he said, on Friday night at 9 o'clock, he's on the phone to the financial director trying to sort out a 5 million rand deal. So this is a tiny deal. This is a multi-million rand company. Mm-hmm. I said, what the hell? He said, yeah, you know, I just had to sort that out. Now, if the MD is on the line to the FD at 9 o'clock on a Friday night, that means he didn't get the bad news quickly enough. That means the culture is sick. There's mistrust, there's fear, there's conflict, there's secrets, there's probably quite a lot of anger, there's insecurity. This is not a culture in which anybody can thrive. You can set the best strategy you like, but Drucker tells us culture will eat strategy for breakfast. So you have to start with the culture, and it's very difficult for people to internalize that, because they say, we don't have time for this culture rubbish. We need results. Good luck with that.
Maybe culture's gotten a bit of a bad rep in some way, because most people then go, well, let's just throw the happiness culture at it. And there's beauty in the happiness culture, but it doesn't actually overlay necessarily onto the brand or the organization. Maybe they're not necessarily optimizing for that, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it becomes that extreme thing, and then, like, it just becomes impossible to bridge that bridge.
You know, you talk about the happiness culture, and I've got nothing against happiness. We all want happiness and joy.
Yeah.
You can't have happiness without vulnerability and authenticity.
Yeah, exactly.
Because otherwise what you're doing is you're putting an elastoplaster on an axe wound.
Yeah, you might as well just be creating a culture of illusion.
Absolutely. And so what's happening is, if you're only rewarding happiness, what's happening is the unhappiness goes underground.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not allowed to be unhappy in the culture. And if that's your culture, you're in big trouble. Because so there's still fear, right?
As you said, that's huge. Because what I'm leaning into and hearing into is it's got to be a whole culture. Like a culture around happiness, a culture around strength, a culture around anything still means something else isn't allowed into the room.
My friend Karen House is big on LinkedIn. She loves LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been battling with LinkedIn for about a year now. I just can't understand why I'm so resistant. And yesterday it occurred to me. On LinkedIn, there are no people.
Mm.
It's a social network without society.
Mm.
If you think about Facebook, right, you can love or hate Facebook, as we all do.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's putting their best foot forward and everybody's wearing this mask of, you know, shiny, happy people. But at least they're people.
Yeah.
They're celebrating their children. They're talking about their weekends. They're complaining about the weather. They're human beings, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking forward to Friday because there's a party.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of that on LinkedIn. On LinkedIn, everybody is so busy trying to be professional, nobody is being there. They're all posting motivational quotes. They're trying to add value with the content. There's zero engagement. I've been posting videos and inspirational quotes on my Facebook. I've got around about the same number of people following me on Facebook and on LinkedIn, about 2,000 in round numbers.
Mm-hmm.
On Facebook, I'm getting hundreds of shares. On LinkedIn, not a single one. And why is that? Because I'm not allowed to be a human being on LinkedIn. And when I had that insight yesterday, I thought, okay, I'm going to be very subversive. I'm going to start posting about my children and my weekend and my life on LinkedIn. And that's a very subversive idea. I'm going to start being a little bit more authentic on LinkedIn and see what happens.
Wow.
And that's quite a subversive idea, because we're told that in the workplace, we're not allowed to have emotions.
Yes.
We're not allowed to have fear. We're not allowed to have excitement. Well, we're allowed to have excitement and joy, but we're not allowed to bring our fears and insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're talking about, the whole culture. If you can't bring your fears and insecurities, your vulnerabilities, then you can't bring your joy, because it's a flip side. You can't have one without the other. And when you see, I think LinkedIn is basically a mirror into the corporate culture.
Oh.
Bring your happiness and your inspiration and your value, but for goodness sake, don't give us any
KPIs,
of this struggle.
And your KPIs as well. And as you say that, it just allows for one foot to always be out, because we can never be our full authentic selves.
Correct.
Yeah.
So bring your left foot to work, but leave your right foot at home.
and maybe leave the pinky as well, just of that notebook.
Correct. Yeah, we're big on index fingers and thumbs. But pinky, no, leave them behind. We don't need them. They're extraneous.
Totally.
So I've got some ideas about what a fear-free culture looks like. And I want to just go back to that case study of how we implemented it and what we did. So the culture was in decline. And the reason for that is there was a lot of politics, and politics is driven by control and fear.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of conflict as a consequence. And that's why we decided to listen first. So the first barometer of culture, number one, is how quickly does the leader hear the bad news?
Mm-hmm.
And in order for the leader to hear the bad news, you have to listen quite carefully instead of talking. So, you know, the old stupid joke is, that's why we've got two ears and one mouth, because we're supposed to be listening twice as much as we talk.
Mm-hmm.
So my first job was, the bad news was not traveling upwards. So we were constantly in crisis. And so what I started to do is I stopped talking and I started listening. And so the first thing is, how healthy is your culture? You just ask, how quickly does bad news travel?
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing, the way to fix that is start listening and ask questions and no judgment. And you know what? People tell you the truth. It's astonishing. People will tell you the bad news if you ask them,
mm-hmm.
and if they feel safe with you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll start off by telling you something very small and minor, and they'll look at your face and see how you react.
Mm-hmm.
And if you react with, tell me more, they'll tell you more. And slowly and slowly, you start building the trust.
Mm-hmm.
So if your bad news is traveling slowly, if you find yourself at 9 o'clock at night on the phone to the FD. That's the time to stop talking and start listening and asking questions.
Of course.
And the next thing you need to do, but the next thing we did, the third thing is, we pushed decisions to the lowest possible level.
Beautiful.
I don't want to be making decisions that other people can make.
Mm.
And this is also quite a subversive idea, because I'm treating people as adults and I'm saying to them, I know that you're scared of making this decision. It's okay. I'm here and I can talk you through it. You get to make the decision and you will make the best decision possible for your team and for what you want to do.
Mm.
And if you want some input, I'm happy to give you the input, but I don't want to make this decision. It's not my decision to make.
Yeah.
And that starts freeing people because they get to take accountability for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not everybody's cup of tea, by the way. Not everybody wants that accountability. Some people want to be told what to do.
Sure.
They want to just be told.
Also, as you say that, I'm hearing into there is that accountability, but there's also that responsibility there. And with that responsibility does come power. So it is scary because nobody wants to be that person that messes up. But there is also this lure to being able to create something meaningful and take responsibility for that and having more power in that.
So isn't that interesting that we say to try and build a fear-free culture is quite scary?
Yeah.
And I think that's the paradox that you have to manage, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want a fear-free culture, rather than trying to deny the fear, what you want to do is get the skills to confront the fear.
Mm-hmm.
Know that it doesn't matter if the fear arises because we have the skills and the tools to confront the fear and overcome it, mm-hmm. rather than just denying it. So that's where the scariness comes from. And that's also where the birthplaces of innovation, you know, this is what Brené Brown tells us.
Mm-hmm.
The birthplace of innovation is overcoming that fear. You know, I can't remember who said it, but somebody says, everything you want is on the other side of fear.
Yes.
And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't confront the fear, like in those fairy stories, you can't get what you want. And if you deny that you've got fear, you can't confront it. And so you're stuck.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that was the third thing we did. We tried to push the decisions down to the lowest level. And I got pushed back on that. People would say, what are you going to do? And I would say, well, what are you going to do? It's your team. It's your unit. It's your responsibility. What are you going to do? Why am I making this decision? And people would look at me as if I'd gone mad because they didn't understand that. And some people just left. They couldn't handle it. They didn't want it. They wanted to be told what to do. And I refused.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, of course, embraced that. And then that's quite hard because sometimes if people embrace it, what they'll do is they'll do things you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll use methods that you don't agree with.
Mm.
And if you want them to do it, you have to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard because, as Peter Block says in his wonderful book, Flawless Consulting, he says, if given the choice, people would rather have control than results.
Yeah.
So when you empower people, you're giving them the power, which means you have to give up power,
mm-hmm.
which as a leader is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to constantly remind myself, do I want the results or do I want the control? And the less I controlled that, the more people controlled their own domains, the less I had to control those domains, which means I could go and do more exciting and more useful things for the organization. If I don't have to micromanage every single unit, that means I can go out and, you know, grow the organization, execute the strategy, do the stuff that only the MD or the chief can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I went and opened new markets, completely new markets, because I was the only person who could do that. I was the only person who could talk to an MD of a bank. You know, I'm running a 2,500 person organization.
Mm-hmm.
They want to deal with the leader. They don't want to deal with anybody else. And if I'm too busy micromanaging the organization, I don't have time to spend time in the future. I don't have time to spend time opening new markets or innovating or inspiring people. I just don't have the time because I'm too busy micromanaging. So that's why it's so important.
The other side of that is an organization wouldn't trust somebody who's having to micromanage. Because it's like, if you can't handle your own ship, how are you going to handle my ship?
Well, you know, it's very comfortable to be micromanaged. I don't have to worry then. Because, and that's delegating upwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry because what will happen is my boss will take care of it. I learned this. I was young. I think I was 25 or 26. I was running a PR company. And I had employed a writer who had a degree. I don't have a degree, but she had a degree. And so I was very impressed. And she came and she started writing press releases for me. And I don't want to say she was useless, Lena, but I certainly wasn't getting the results that I wanted. Mm. And I was incredibly frustrated. Mm. And I was speaking to a mentor of mine and I said, you know, man, this is frustrating. She's got this degree in marketing. She's supposed to be able to do this job. And I'm not getting the results. And so I'm having to do her work and my work and still pay her. Mm. And this woman said to me, this mentor of mine, she said to me, just describe the process. I said, well, she'd write her press release and it won't be very good. And then she'll give it to me and I'll fix it. And she said to me, stop doing that. I said, what? She said, stop fixing it. I said, but I can't just stop fixing it. It's not acceptable. I want results. She said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to take the press release and you're going to look at it very carefully and you're going to say, it's very good. I think it needs a little bit more pizzazz. I said, that's not concrete feedback. You can't give people feedback like, I want more pizzazz. She says, well, then what you can say is, it needs to be strengthened a bit. Can you give it a bit more zing? Mm. I said, don't be ridiculous. I can't give her that kind of feedback. And this woman said to me, look, what you're doing is you're training your employee that you will do her work. She only has to do a tiny bit of work. Mm-hmm. You do the quality control and you will finish the job for her. Mm-hmm. You have to make it rebound back on her. You have to empower her to do her own job. And the only way you're going to do that is to make her struggle. So I thought this was the craziest idea I had ever heard in my young life. But I thought, I've got nothing to lose because I'm frustrated as all get-go. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened the next time. And my employee looked at me. Her name was Janice. She looked at me as if I'd gone completely crazy. And then she came back and it was slightly better. And I would say, this is fantastic. You know, you really have strengthened it. It just needs a little bit more, I don't know, it needs to be a bit more robust. Mm-hmm. And she would go away. She would take a whole day on a single press release of sort of 300 words. And then eventually I would relent and say, okay, here's what I mean. Can we strengthen it by doing this? Can we move this paragraph over here? Can we take out these adjectives? And what would start happening is the stuff that I started getting rose in quality and it got better and better. And so now all of a sudden I had coached her basically by giving her quite vague parameters. I said, I want it strong. And she was learning what that meant. Mm-hmm. I wasn't micromanaging her anymore. She was learning how to manage herself. And she became quite a good writer, actually. She was fantastic. We succeeded enormously.
So I just wanted to kind of jump back into that point that you're making, because I think it's such a powerful thing in terms of us being mentored or us mentoring others in and then really allowing for a space of growth to happen. Like I remember when I was still studying and at one point I wanted to do script writing and it wasn't something that I had studied per se, but I wanted to develop that skill set and had a really amazing mentor that I wrote my script and then he kind of looked back and goes, rewrite the whole thing for lighting, rewrite the whole thing for the unspoken word, rewrite the whole thing for ambience. And it was a frustrating exercise in the very beginning. But then to be able to see all the intricacies in that and to really grow that quality, yeah, wow. It doesn't feel like we do enough of that. So I'm so glad that you brought that example in.
And you see, that's where the two things about that. The first one is a lot of people like being told what to do. The second thing is a lot of leaders like micromanaging. They like telling other people what to do. And the reason for that is because they're hiding away, right? Mm. It's much more difficult to go and open new markets and to be strategic and to be the big picture thinker and to set the direction and all of that. That's hard. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Yep.
That's much more difficult. But to micromanage, now I feel like I'm contributing. I feel like I'm getting things done, but I'm doing the wrong stuff. And so that's I think, one of the hidden reasons why cultures are fear-based and not empowerment-based. That's the reason that the power is concentrated at the top rather than going to the lowest possible level. There's a guy called Brian Robertson, and he's got this book, Holacracy, and it talks quite a lot about how to devolve power to the lowest possible level. It's quite a complicated model to understand. And it has lots of detractors, but I think there is some kernel of truth in there. And I think there are ways of doing it. It's a fascinating read. Mm. I think it's a bit too kind of heavy on the systems, but it's a fascinating read and it's really very interesting.
I've heard it. It's definitely been one of those books that's been recommended in my field, so I'll definitely check it out. And I have heard that feedback as well of it being loaded. And maybe as we step into these spaces more and co-create these spaces more, the learning will become so much more exponential and we'll be able to share in a much easier way where the growth really is.
I think with the Holacracy in particular, it is very good at devolving authority to the lowest person, to the lowest level. It has its detractors. It's got its roots. I mean, he doesn't disclose this, but it's got its roots in a thing called sociocracy, which is in the 1970s. Okay. And the big complaint or criticism is that it doesn't really scale. I think it works quite well. He's from a very structured engineering, software engineering business. I think it works quite well for companies like that. Their big case study is Tony Hsieh at Zappos. It's a billion-dollar company, so it can't be too bad. But even then, it was collapsing under its own weight a little bit there. So it's got a huge amount of potential, I think, but also, you know, you can't adopt these things without adapting them. But I think it is the key thing there is that it's trying to get the lowest possible level to make the decisions rather than people at the top or people who think they should be making decisions. And that frees people up to do the more important work or the more appropriate work. It's just as important. I mean, I learned this is a very interesting case study. There's a company of gyms, you know, places where you go to work out.
Yeah.
And so these guys, they had a conference and they were recognizing people, and there's one particular gym trainer, and he was very happy with himself and he'd done very well. And one of his customers was there and clients was there, and he was saying, "Oh, this guy was amazing. You changed my life." And this gym trainer was taking all of the credits. And the MD stood up and said, "You're taking the credits. Oh, yes, I changed that woman's life. Okay. Tell me, who cleaned the gym for you?" He says, "Right. So who cleaned the gym? Who took the booking? Who maintained the equipment? Who bought the equipment? Who maintained the equipment?" There was a whole apparatus behind this trainer, and he wasn't taking any of that into account. He says, "All you did was execute the training plan." Who set up the training plan? We've got experts for that.
Yeah.
So don't think that one job is any more important than another. It's more appropriate for the leader to be doing some kinds of jobs. And it's more appropriate for the receptionist to be doing other kinds of jobs. But for goodness sake, you know, my dad always says, don't buy a dog and then bark. That's the dog's job.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, don't buy a dog and then bark. And so, you know, that's what I was doing. I was just trying to devolve that authority to the lowest possible level. So, I mean, we've got 4 points so far. Number one, how fast does bad news travel?
Yes.
Number two, start listening, because then you'll start hearing the bad news a bit quicker. And you have to listen with an open heart, an open mind, and without judgment. The third one is push the decisions down to the lowest level. And that comes with its own challenges, right?
Sure.
We feel if we're giving other people control, then we don't have control. We're trusting other people to manage themselves. And that can be very threatening and very difficult for leaders, because they think, well, what am I going to do now with my days? When you do that, you also have to expect mistakes, and you have to welcome the mistakes. You have to actually encourage the mistakes when you push those decisions to the lowest level. And then you have to coach people through those decisions. When I learned this, I was a journalist, and this woman, she was the MD of the publishing company. And every week we would have a Monday morning meeting, and she would give out 3 awards. And the first award was the Above and Beyond Award. And you weren't allowed to nominate yourself. You had to nominate somebody else who'd gone above and beyond. The second award was very interesting. The second award was, who has failed the most this week? It was a floating trophy, and the trophy was a garden broom.
Wow.
And you could only nominate yourself for that award. And what was interesting about that was she was actually forming the culture by using these 2 awards.
Yeah.
And the way she was doing that is she was saying only certain kinds of above and beyond are going to be recognized, or when she had to adjudicate which one is going to get the bag award, the over and above beyond award, and which one is going to get the broom, the mistake award. And so very often what happened was that the over and above beyond would go to the finance team because they had, I remember the one time, they had reduced the debtor's book from 45 days to 30 days. Mm-hmm. They said, right, nobody else is going to get it. I'm giving it to the finance team.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter who'd done what because they had worked hard and that was what she was rewarding. She's actually creating culture at that moment.
Yes.
And that's what you've got to do when you start pushing these decisions to the lowest level. You've got to expect the mistakes. And by giving us that broom award, she was rewarding the mistakes. I would have that broom next to me the whole week. Mm-hmm. And in order to win the broom, you had to disclose what your mistake was. You had to disclose how you had fixed that mistake. And you had to disclose what you had learned so that you never made that mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're encouraging people. You're actually rewarding people for making mistakes and for disclosing them.
And what I love about that example as well is there's just so much more enrichment. The matrix just becomes so much more rich because of that, because it's not just one hierarchical scale of achievement.
No.
There's multiple threads and everything's allowed and everything's welcomed. And
yeah, we started this conversation by saying you can bring your whole self to work, right?
Yeah.
What you want to do is hold people accountable to culture, not to results. And, you know, go straight back to the very first thing that we did as a team.
Mm-hmm.
People must be heard. We must listen to people. If people are feeling heard, then we're going to succeed. And that's what we try to do. We just try to listen to people. And that was the culture we try to set up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets quite practical. Then you start running effective meetings. So I guess that's step five, you know? And running effective meetings, again, is holding people accountable, not to you, but to themselves. Mm-hmm. What did you say you were going to do? Do you want to do it? And there's a wonderful book by a guy called Fournies, Fournies.
Okay.
And it's called Why Employees Don't Do What They're Supposed To.
Brilliant.
Yeah. It's a little book. It's a tiny little book. It's got 14 tips.
Okay.
You will not believe the power of these things. Eh? You will not believe the power of it. Mm-hmm. And that's when you run an effective meeting, that's what you want to do. And so one of the reasons that people don't do what they're supposed to do is they don't agree with the way you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't know why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they think that their way is better.
Yes.
Or they think that your way won't work.
Yeah.
So normally when people are not doing what they say they're going to do or they're supposed to be doing, we scold them.
Mm-hmm.
Or we hold them accountable, which means basically scaring them.
Yes.
We withhold their pay. We make them work overtime.
Mm-hmm.
Or what will sometimes happen is we'll train them. Oh, this person's not doing what they're supposed to do. Obviously, he doesn't know how to do it. We'll go and train him or her. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's not the reason. Only one out of the 14 reasons is they don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So one of the reasons is they don't know how to do it. Another reason is it can't be done. This is just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a third reason is this person can't do it. It's just outside their skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 3 out of 14.
Sure.
There are another 11 reasons why people are resistant to doing it, doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, here's one. They think they're already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You think they're not doing it, but they think they are.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, and this is counterintuitive, they get punished for doing what they're supposed to do. There's a negative consequence.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I'm on flexi time, I come in late and my boss is scolding me because I'm in late, but I'm on flexi time, then all of a sudden I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, but
mm-hmm.
I'm being scolded. Or I'm working from home, right?
Yeah.
And now the boss is micromanaging me and I'm getting negative mm-hmm. reinforcement for the thing I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
It's not a brilliant
like
example.
Pavlov's dog-gone nightmare. It just becomes way too managed.
Absolutely. I mean, my favorite example of this, in fact, is the British Raj in India.
Uh-huh.
They had a problem, I think it was in Calcutta, with rats.
Okay.
And so what the Brits decided to do was reward anybody who brought in a dead rat.
Ooh.
So they said, please bring in dead rats and that'll get rid of the rat problem. And it took about 30 seconds for somebody to start a rat farm just outside the city.
Wow.
Because now they're being rewarded for bringing in rats.
Uh-huh. amazing.
This is, yeah. So just be careful with what you reward and what you punish.
That's exactly the culture you end up creating. Yeah. Phenomenal.
So that's the, you know, the unintended consequence. So there's lots of reasons why people don't do what, in brackets they, or in quotes, they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So to run an effective meeting, you need to hold people accountable to themselves. Mm-hmm. And then you have to coach them through the things that are preventing them from performing. Mm-hmm. And my favorite phrase is here is, it's called buy-in. It's not called sell-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You need to get people to buy in. Then they need to agree with what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And then you need to give them
in that meeting, it's setting the ethos and the agenda of what's allowed in that meeting. I mean, obviously you want to bring more in, but having some sort of a container can help, because if the meeting is designed to be creative and then you start penalizing people for doing something different, then you're kind of doing a counterintuitive culture there.
Completely. So yes. That'll never work.
Yeah.
We tried it once and it didn't work. It's too expensive. All of these things. Mm-hmm. That stuff wasn't allowed in our meetings. So if somebody comes and says, I've got this idea, I'd say, great. How are you going to execute it? How much is it going to cost? Where are you going to find the money? Mm-hmm. What's going to stand in your way? Not, it'll never work. We have tried that. What have you learned from our previous experience?
Hmm.
What do you think the downsides are?
Hmm.
I can see the upsides. What downsides do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So again, you're coaching them through it, but it's their decision. They must make it and they must either succeed or fail. It's not up to me. They must succeed or fail. And that's where the buy-in comes from, right?
Yeah. And also the way you frame those questions is so powerful, because it's, in a way, they're allowing the other person to think about all the different layers and complexities and issues that can arise with it without shooting down the idea or them, because sometimes we get so attached to the idea that we think it's a personal attack on us.
Absolutely.
Rather than the thing that we're proposing.
And this is, De Bono's got these six thinking hats, mm-hmm. and that's hell of a useful. I mean, he tried to popularize a word called PO, which he wanted it to be beyond yes and no. Now that never took off, but the idea is correct. The idea is listen to an idea or listen to a suggestion without judgments, without thinking yes or no, just listen to the idea with an open mind and hold that ambiguity in place. And that's hard for people to do.
It is.
You know, they want a yes or no answer. They want it to be black and white,
mm-hmm.
but black and white thinking never got us anywhere. You know, things are always gray, and the more senior you become, the more things, you know, just are gray. So you're quite right. There are different kinds of meetings. Some are operational meetings, some are creative meetings. The trick is to try and be effective with those meetings, and there are different ways of running meetings. And in fact, you know, our consulting business, that's what we do. We just run meetings, essentially. That's the essential thing of what we do. Sometimes they're trading meetings. Sometimes they're facilitated consensus building meetings. Sometimes they're innovation meetings. Sometimes they're operational meetings, and we get through an enormous amount. We can get through 20 or 30 agenda items in an hour.
Brilliant.
Because we know how to run an effective meeting.
Yeah.
So that's a skill all on its own.
It is.
And it's an incredibly important and useful skill, because, you know, people say, oh, we spend too much time in meetings. I say, yeah, that's true. Try to get something done without a meeting, though.
Mm-hmm.
You have to meet somebody. You have to meet, even if it's your bank manager,
mm-hmm.
you have to meet your client. You have to meet your team.
Yeah.
You have to meet the operations guys. You have to meet the salespeople.
Mm-hmm.
Try and get something done in an organization without a meeting. See how far you get.
Mm-hmm.
Because we live in a world where there's teamwork, and teamwork requires team meetings. So it's not that the meetings are too long. It's that the meetings are ineffective.
Exactly. It's the structure. It's not the personal thing. It's the structural thing that's incorrect.
You're 100% correct.
Yeah.
And the problem is the personal comes in, especially in fear-based cultures.
Sure.
You didn't do what you said you were going to do. Now I'm irritated with you. I don't trust you to do what you're going to do. So next time I'm just not going to ask you.
Yeah.
So the meetings become sort of attacks, person-to-person attacks, or people resent it, or people are not talking because they're keeping secrets. And then you find yourself on the phone to the FD at 9 o'clock on a Friday. This is the opposite of what you want.
Back here again. Yeah. No, for sure.
Absolutely.
Prophecy.
Absolutely. And then, you know, to get that buy-in, you need to set a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the strategy stuff, right? So part of what I do is I do the how to run a meeting and how to run your own life, sort of team and personal productivity training.
Mm-hmm.
We do that. And we also do, and this may be counterintuitive, we do presentation skills and speech skills, how to deliver an effective speech. And why is that? Because a strategy is a narrative. A strategy is a story. Mm-hmm. And so you're telling a story of how the organization could be. And you're telling a story about how the industry could be. Mm-hmm. And you're telling a story about who your customers are and could be, mm-hmm. and what they could be, and who you can be. Mm-hmm. And so a strategy, a good strategy, is actually a story.
Yeah.
And that's, and a story is a vision as well. And there you go back to the buy-in, right? If you can do that well, you're going to get the buy-in. And if you get the buy-in, then people are going to want to perform. And then you give them the opportunity to do that by pushing decisions to the lowest level. Absolutely. And when they don't do it very well or they make mistakes, you'll reward them for that, mm-hmm. because you want the bad news to travel fast. Mm-hmm. And you listen to them and you coach them and you understand where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is quick wins. So that's number seven, quick wins. You, what you want to do is try to get a quick win or two in the first 2 or 3 weeks, in the first 2 or 3 months after that. And then you can go for 6 months without a win. But what you want to do is try and get a win in the first 2 or 3 weeks, and then another one in the first 2 or 3 months. It can be a small win, sure. but just to demonstrate that this culture is working. And then when you get the win, you give the culture the credit. Look at what we can achieve as a team because we're listening to each other. Look at what we can achieve as a team because we're resolving the conflict. Look at what we can achieve as a team because we're disclosing the bad news early.
Exactly.
You see how amazing that was? We succeeded as a team because we disclosed the bad news early.
Yeah. And I think that's, so, again, you said that, it was so powerful because you're not individuating. It's not like, oh, well done, you know, Eric, for that thing that you did, and then making it again a competitive thing. It's
exactly,
we all exactly. made this together because every part of that ecosystem was needed to make that happen.
Yeah, that whole teamwork of the gyms, absolutely.
Yeah.
So if I want to just summarize, the first thing is, how healthy is your culture?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how fast does bad news travel? How do you know? How many fires are you putting out at 9 o'clock on Friday night? Then how do you fix that? Number two, you listen and you ask questions. And then once you've done that, you try, and number three, push decisions to the lowest possible level.
Mm-hmm.
And number four, now you're setting the culture and you want to set the culture early. So if you can, if you've got a new team, set this culture of collaboration, of not keeping secrets, of resolving conflict, of no scolding and, quote, holding people accountable. Try and set that culture early. And the way you do that is by hiring slowly and firing quickly. People aren't adhering to the culture, they need to be moved either to somewhere else or out of the organization.
Mm.
And then number five, run effective meetings. And, you know, you've touched on some very pertinent points. Make sure you know what the meeting is for. Make sure that the people are not being attacked, that that you've got an agenda, that you're structuring it correctly, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, that's a whole skill in itself. So that's number five. And number six is set some sort of vision, because that's what the strategy is. Strategy is a vision. That's number six, and it's a story, right? Mm-hmm. So that story, and then you have to be good at telling that story in a compelling way. And that's why the presentation skills are so important. And then finally, get some quick wins. And so that's where the innovation comes in from.
Yes. If
you've got a fear-free culture, all of a sudden people will start experimenting.
Yeah.
You're rewarding mistakes, so they're prepared to make the mistakes. And if you do that, all of a sudden people will come with ideas, because ideas are a dime a dozen, really. And ideas are fragile things. I can come to you with a brilliant idea, and it's easier for me to say, no, it's a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more difficult to say, yes, it's a brilliant idea, because there's more risk involved. But if you can get a fear-free culture, now all of a sudden you can have that innovation. And so if you think about the boutique agency that I run, it's Strativation Strategy, which is selling that narrative, that buy in, not sell in. The second one is empowerment, leadership. That's the in Strativation. It's leadership. And that's coaching and pushing the decisions to the lowest level and
mm-hmm.
trying to get the organization firing on all cylinders, making sure everybody can contribute as much as they can. And then finally, the innovation. And that's the kind of output of a fear-free culture.
Beautiful.
And so those are some of the things that we've spoken about today.
Oh, amazing. amazing, amazing. And I love what percolated out of this conversation and what can now percolate in so many different people as they feel into that themselves and their own business ecosystem for themselves and lean into that in the paths that they work in.
Well, I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity. If you don't mind, if I can give you a web link.
Yes, exactly. I wanted you to just speak into that.
Thank you so much. So we're running a time, personal and team effectiveness training. It's called Time Mastery. And you can find us at timemastery.co. And the kind of umbrella brand, if you like, is Strativation. And that's Strat from strategy, E-R. And then Vation from innovation. So it's strativation.com. And you can find us there. We've got a podcast. We've got all sorts of offerings there. And you can find us on the internet there. And then all the sort of Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn links are all there.
Well, we'll definitely make sure to add all of that to the show notes as well.
I'm so grateful, Lina. Was that useful for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So give me two or three things that you found useful or thought-provoking or interesting.
Well, just this invitation to seeing fear in a different way. It's not what you disassociate with and not include in the room and just making things pretty and bringing it about light and happy, but it's that all that holistic, bringing all the elements in, like that really, really resonates for me. I can feel that still moving through my body. And
wonderful.
Yeah. And again, also coming from like that brand kind of background as well, the narrative that we need to be leaving, like this is really a strategy, and the strategy is a story embodied, a story told,
yep,
a story actioned. I really love that. I mean, I loved everything. Like everything just gets absorbed. But if I had to pull out two, since you asked, those two nuggets really just stood out as the first things that I can put out there. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Hmm.
Well, again, thank you so much for the invitation and for the opportunity and for the opportunity. It's been a real honor and a pleasure to talk this stuff through with you. You know, I forget sometimes, we know what we know, and so we forget that we know it, right?
So
just talking you through it and just making the notes in preparation for this interview has been very useful for me as well. So I want to say thank you so much, and all strength to your elbow. I wish Supernovas the podcast a lot of success.
So there you have it. There's no more room at the edge of maybe. In fact, maybes have been taken out and scrapped on the list altogether. Because you're not just in business to create products and services. I mean, that might have been what got you out of bed this morning. That might be what's getting you to pay the bills. But you're here to own so much more. You're here to encapsulate so much more and embody so much more. You're actually in the business of creating openings, shaping connections, and establishing engagement. And this is your exact moment in the space-time continuum to find yours. Because you are moments away from being in the whole new class of emergence and sharing your genius in a very unique, bold way. This has been Lena Ski for the Supernova Podcast. And if you like this, love this, absolutely roared about this, check on over to our Patreon page, because there's some extra awesome things happening there for all our patrons. And of course, we could always do with more exponential love to really catapult this future of work into the way that's actually going to make a difference in the world. But, and so much more, if you're ready to become magnetic, evolutionary, and a whole lot more in charge of what it is you're putting out into the world, and intuitively design the products, businesses, service, solutions, and the talents you need to discover and deliver that thing that's unique to you and the DNA of what it is that's being birthed in this moment, you're gonna love everything else happening over at www.lenaski.com. See you there.